This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Sammy Mack.
Listen to this list of names, Sammy. Michael McMullen, Logan Hancock, Dakota Styles, Ezra Raphael, Cherish Periwinkle, Brianna Cooper, just a half dozen of the more than 450 Florida kids known to the Department of Children and Families who've died in the past 6 years. Innocence Lost, an investigative series by our partner Miami Herald, exhaustively detailed 477 child death cases with prior contact to the agency. Carol Marvin Miller is with us now, one of the co-authors of the series in the Miami Herald. Carol, some real exhaustive, detailed, emotionally exhaustive work, I imagine. The DCF philosophy has been to preserve the family. What impact does it have on child safety?
Well, what we found is that over the last 6 years, as DCF very rigorously implemented this family preservation program, they also slashed budgets for services that would have kept children more safe within the homes of their parents. And as a result of that, the number of children known to, the number of children with families known to the state who died just increased very dramatically.
And the agency's response to that dramatic increase was what?
Not much, actually. Records that we reviewed showed that even as other experts were warning the Department of Children and Families administrators that the policy was erroneous, that children were being harmed, the agency continued on the same path. DCF had some studies that they were relying on that they said showed that children fare better when they don't enter the foster care system. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, foster care is not a good way to raise children. But the studies upon which they were relying mostly involved teenagers, adolescents, much older children who could pick up a phone and dial 911, who could speak for themselves and defend themselves. The overwhelming majority of the children who died that we wrote about were infants and toddlers and children younger than five.
Mm-hmm. And so what is best practice and what should Florida have been doing?
Well, for starters, if you're going to implement a very rigorous family preservation program, you have to have resources to spend on families that you are leaving intact. If, for instance, you're leaving children with a drug-addicted mother, you have to insist that she accept, complete, and succeed in drug treatment. You can't just accept her word that she's not going to be a drug addict, because that doesn't work. You also have to have other services, parenting classes, anger management for violent paramours, but you have to be willing to pull the trigger when a child has to be removed for his or her protection. And the records we reviewed showed that DCF has been all but reluctant to do that. And so we have cases in which children who were hideously physically abused were returned to their abusers and then killed. A little boy named Logan Hancock, mm-hmm. who suffered a depressed skull fracture, which doctors reported was indicative of physical abuse. They didn't know which caregiver cracked his skull, so they gave him right back, and within about 2 weeks, his mother beat him to death.
You talked about the services that parents would necessarily need in order to have any semblance of rationale behind the preservation of families philosophy that DCF has operated on for the better part of a decade. The agency has used these signed safety plans, essentially promissory notes of good behavior on the part of caregivers and parents, but yet with no real retribution when those safety plans are violated.
Well, there's no oversight. The way DCF was operating with regard to these safety plans is they were no more than pledges. I pledge to be a better parent. I promise to supervise my children adequately. I promise to no longer be a drug addict. Yeah. Well, it's not that those folks had bad intentions, but you're not going to cure a drug addiction on the promise of a parent to no longer be an addict. It just doesn't work. And because they were relying on nothing but those pieces of paper, we had about 84 bad outcomes where in some history of that family, you know, there was at least one or more of those safety plans, and then a child died. It's bad child welfare. It's bad social work. Everyone with expertise in this world will tell you that it's not effective and it doesn't protect children.
Let's talk about the funding mechanism real quick. Governor Scott, even prior to your investigative series, talked about a $40 million increase to the 2014-2015 budget cycle for this agency. That would be a 1.5% increase, Sammy, from the current spending plans for the DCF. Is that money going to come, do you think, Carol? And if so, where is that money most needed within the system?
Well, it's needed everywhere. Let me say this for starters. The somewhere between 30 and 40 million that the governor has pledged to help fix this problem is not enough. It's not in the ballpark for enough. Last budget year, the governor and legislature, counting vetoes, shed $100 million from DCF's child protection budget. So the $40 million doesn't even begin to cover what was taken out just a year ago. Moreover, the system is not working. We don't have enough child protective investigators. They are not paid adequately. They are not trained adequately. The services that need to be brought to bear within the families that are left intact are not adequate. We have a simply abysmal drug treatment program in Florida. There has been little to no will to fix it because drug treatment is expensive. You are not going to cure a drug addict within a 28-day McTreatment program. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. You know, when you've got a woman or a man with 6, 8, or 10 years worth of drug addiction and all the dysfunction that goes with it, 28 days worth of drug treatment doesn't begin to solve that problem. And when you start looking at 6 months worth of inpatient aggressive drug treatment, it's expensive. And even that doesn't always work.
Carol Marvin-Miller, thank you so much for joining us. That's Carol Marvin-Miller with the Miami Herald, who has been working on the Innocence Lost Project. You can talk to us about what you think about this story at WLRN on Twitter, or go to WLRN.org to participate in our live blog. Coming up, we'll talk about the end of the FCAT.
Thanks, guys.
I'm Sammy Mack.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening. A pledge special Florida Roundup here today on WLRN.
Our guest right now, State Impact Florida education reporter John O'Connor, who joins us from Tampa, and in a few minutes, our Latin America's editor, Tim Padgett. Your questions are welcome for the panel. Email us with your first name and a location to the Florida Roundup at WLRNnews.org. We're going to be talking about the FCAT. Tell us what your favorite FCAT memory is. You can also tweet us at WLRN. I've been hearing a lot about people who got t-shirts during the FCAT. And we also have our live blog where you can join us online, hosted by our fabulous intern, Diego Saldana Rojas. You can find that discussion on our website, WLRN.org. So one of the stories we're talking about this week is the end of the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test. This April is the last FCAT that students will take in Florida. The FCAT has been on its way out for a while. Florida's been transitioning to new standards in English, language arts, and math. These are the Common Core standards that most states in the country are adopting. And new standards mean schools need a new tool to see if students are learning what they're supposed to. So this week, the state education commissioner recommended a new test. John O'Connor, what do we know about it? Oh, I'm afraid John O'Connor is not on the line yet. We'll be working on getting him. But in the meantime, as we are talking about the end of the FCAT, one of the things that we've been doing, Tom, is asking people for their memories because mm-hmm. we are preparing to write the obituary for the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test.
I think none too soon for some parents and some teachers after suffering through this for many, many years and all the ups and downs that are involved with this kind of state assessment and looking at state standards and all the preparation that is done in classrooms across Florida and certainly in households. And I know in my home at the kitchen table.
And I just got word from our engineer, John. Can you hear us? Looks like John O'Connor is still not with us, so we'll get to that in a minute.
The idea, though, here, Sammy, and is significant, is this is a huge transition. This is an industrial change for the education industry here in the state of Florida, moving from FCAT, the state standard that's been in place for many, many years, and moving toward
1997.
Moving toward what until this week was unknown. This week, the Florida Department of Education finally made a selection in terms of the direction it was going to head for this test to deal with the Common Core state standards, which, as we've been reporting, is not a curriculum, but yet a standard, is a strategy, is a goal.
That's right. So Florida has been a real pioneer in the United States for measuring how well students are doing. And of course, there's been a lot of controversy along the way. But Florida was one of the first states to really make standardized testing part of how we know or how we value or evaluate our public education system and whether or not we are hitting the targets that we set out for ourselves. And so in 1997, there had been other forms of standardized tests that the state had used before then. But 1997 is when we introduced the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test. And that was really the beginning of what became an incredibly powerful tool, not just in how it measures the sort of moment that students are in and whether or not that they're hitting those goals, but also it has, of course, become part of the formula for school grades, which has an impact on funding. It has an impact on the value-added model that we talk about when we talk about teacher pay and how teachers are graded on their students.
FCAT has become a way to measure a kid, to measure a classroom, to measure a school, to measure a school district. I mean, it really starts at the singular desk of the student and emanates from there. This FCAT test over the last decade and a half or so has grown into the ability, with all of its warts acknowledged, to judge the work that's done in the classroom, to judge the work that's done in administration offices across the entire state.
And what's really interesting about what's happening right now is with the Common Core state standards that most of the states in the U.S. are moving towards, these are the standards that are expected of each student in their grade levels, there was a group of people. Oh, we have word that John O'Connor is on the line. John, we were just talking about this new test that Florida is getting. What can you tell us about it?
Well, we don't know a whole lot right now because actually Florida and the company have not signed a contract yet. So they are still negotiating on the test. What they have told us is it'll be about the same length of time as the current FCAT testing. You'll have more grades taking some of the tests. For instance, there is a writing exam every year rather than in selected grades right now. The test will be online mostly, although there will be an option for pencil and paper. So that's kind of what we know right now, and they are still working out some of the final details.
John, is it preemptive then? Is it presumptuous to say that the State Department of Education has its solution to what comes after FCAT?
Well, the metaphor that the Department of Education uses, this is like buying a house. So they have signed the contract. They know they've committed to buying the house. Right now, they're kind of haggling over who's going to pay what for the roof or for the water heater. I have the bid documents, for instance.
And so what do we know from those documents?
There's some interesting stuff in there. We're probably going to post a story this afternoon, but a little breaking news for you guys. But the writing test, for instance, will be graded by both human graders and a computer program, which is something new for Florida. In the past, Florida has used two human graders. They've compared the scores and then kind of averaged the scores. The human grader would be the primary reader, and then the computer grade would then just be used to kind of verify the human score.
John, what's the next process involved with this? And tell us about some of the dollars that are involved.
Well, the contract is 6 years and $220 million. And what's interesting from the bid documents is that the initial proposal from the company was for $323 million. So through the course of the negotiations, they actually came back and trimmed about $100 million off of the cost.
What are they not what are they not buying for that?
Well, that one of the biggest things, $30 million, is by using computerized grading on the writing test. That's the biggest chunk of savings. There's some other things. It's a very aggressive schedule for eliminating pencil and paper tests, for instance. They estimate 2% of all testing will be done with pencil and paper. So that would put a little more pressure on school districts to get their technology up to speed.
Exactly, Sammy. You and I have spoken to the superintendent of Miami-Dade and Broward, and this is a key point that they've said. First of all, what is after FCAT? Apparently, we're close to an answer to that. But if there's technology involved with that, technology involved with taking those assessment tests, is that the best use of technology funds for a one-and-done kind of test as opposed to technology being infused in the curricula throughout K through 12 in public education?
Well, certainly what happens with the test and what the requirements are of the test is going to have an impact on the kinds of technology that classrooms use, because they need to have something that's compatible with this thing that all of their students are going to end up taking. But one of the bigger issues that has come out, I spoke with Superintendent Alberto Carvalho yesterday, and as we were leading up to this process, the notion that this test was going to not be field tested in Florida has been really controversial with educators across the board, from the classroom to the superintendent.
Explain that, though, right? Because the and John, pipe in here as well. The idea behind Common Core is, I think, defined in the first term used in the phrase Common Core, right? The assessment of what's being taught in a classroom in Weston ought to be able to be measured against what's being taught in a classroom in Salt Lake City, and a classroom in Sacramento, and a classroom in Providence.
That's true. But what anybody who has taken the FCAT in the past 10 years will tell you is that there is a lot of test prep that happens with it. That's not just about making sure you learn the material, but it's also about making sure that you understand how to answer the test.
The mechanics themselves.
Read the first sentence, read the last sentence, read the topic sentences, then go through again on the reading comprehension. These are the sorts of strategies that something like a prep course for a standardized test would give you. And so there's a lot riding on these tests, and the teachers want to be confident that they can make sure that their students have every advantage, including knowing how to take the test. So that part isn't a barrier.
John, but is that a little bit of a red herring here involved with, you know, we want to field test this test because it's got to be right for Florida teachers and Florida kids? But isn't that just another way, I suppose one could argue, if you're field testing the test, you're also being able to see the test and get the techniques involved in the procedures and the mechanics of the assessment itself?
Yeah, that is the reasoning for the superintendents, where they're coming from, is they'd like to be able to practice on the exam before it really counts. Some more details on how this thing is going to be field tested. What is actually going to happen here is the first year of the exam in Florida is going to use questions that they have been using on the Utah statewide exam. And so as the exam progresses, there'll be more and more and more questions that are designed specifically for the Florida exam. So essentially, we're kind of using somebody else's state exam for the first year, and then we're going to over the next course of the next couple of years, create our own exam in the process.
I can imagine, Sammy, math questions involved that are mentioning canyons and large dried out lakes.
Right.
And the next year there's you know, math questions involving alligators and turtles.
Well, yes. Yesterday, Superintendent Carvalho did point out that there is a bit of a difference between the population of Utah and the population of Florida. And look, like, some of these things really matter. If you put vocab words in front of kids who have never seen these things before, there's some question about what'll happen. All right, thanks so much for joining us, John O'Connor in Tampa. And you can join the conversation. Tweet us at WLRN. And on our website, we have our live chat. Joining us now in the Florida Roundup is WLRN's Latin America's editor, Tim Padgett. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much.
This week, you've been following elections and drug violence in El Salvador. What's going on?
Well, they finally declared a winner in a presidential runoff contest for March 10th that was about as razor thin as you can get. The winner from the leftist FMLN party, who's also the current vice president of the country, Salvador Sanchez Serén, defeated the right-wing candidate from the Arena party, Norman Quijano, by less than a quarter of a percentage point. And that sort of indicates to you just how politically polarized El Salvador still remains, you know, a generation after a civil war that tore it apart.
Tim, who is it that decides this election? Is it the equivalent of Bush versus Gore? Going to the high court?
Just about. It was the electoral commission in El Salvador had to make the final decision. The loser, Quijano, has not accepted the results. And in fact, there was a chilling moment last week when he suggested that the military should actually intervene in this. And that raised all the old ghosts of the Civil War again. Now, fortunately, the military did not accept that invitation. And I think that was a good sign. It shows that El Salvador has, institutionally anyways, matured a lot since those dark days of the 1980s.
You know, Sammy, the U.S. military has talked about this area in Central America as really being the most dangerous part of the Western Hemisphere.
Oh, yes.
Is that a domestic issue? I mean, clearly it's an international issue, but was it an issue at the polls?
Oh, of course. And those are the two. I think the reason that the FMLN, which is the party of the former guerrillas that fought the military during the Civil War, I think the reason that they're eking out these victories, this is the second consecutive presidential victory they've had, is because there is such deep-seated poverty still in El Salvador, and on top of that, the awful, horrific gang violence that is plaguing not just El Salvador, but its neighbors there in what's called the Northern Triangle of Central America.
How does that connect to Honduras and Guatemala?
Oh, very much so. What you've got is a phenomenon in the Northern Triangle of Central America where the Mexican drug cartels have begun to sort of eke their way down south, and they're connecting with these already established vicious gangs known as the Maras. And that has created a cocktail that is just, as I said before, plaguing this region of Central America and making it, as Tom pointed out, what U.S. officials are calling the most dangerous corner of the planet outside of Iraq and Afghanistan.
But at one point, hadn't there been negotiations for peace treaties between some of these gangs? I mean, what happened with that?
Right. When the FMLN took power about 4 or 5 years ago, one of the things they tried to do was reverse this policy that the right-wing government had in place, which was called la mano dura, or the hard hand against the gangs. Well, that policy, unfortunately, only worsened, exacerbated the problems. So the FMLN comes in and they decide, well, let's try negotiating with the gangs, see if we can work out some truces. Well, it only worked to a certain extent. The violence really has not abated. And this is one of Sanchez's big challenges now as the president of El Salvador, is to find a way to get tough on the gangs, but also negotiate with them, get them to a place where they're just not destroying the fabric of this society anymore.
What does this mean for immigration from El Salvador to the United States?
Oh, a lot. I think people in South Florida, we sort of take it for granted that we've always had a large Central American community here. Mm-hmm. The reality is we haven't. In the 20th century, we did not have a large Central American community here. Most of it was concentrated in places like L.A. and Washington, D.C. But over the past decade, we've seen the migrant population from countries like Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, especially Nicaragua, jump 100%. More than 100%. And it's because of these problems. I mean, one of the things that we point out this week in our piece is that a lot of people don't know, for example, that Salvadorans are now poised to overtake Cubans as the third largest Latino group in the United States.
Tim, how much is this between political asylum and economic asylum, just kind of escaping these economies that have been hollowed out by these gangs and by the violence?
It's a combination of both. And that's one of the dilemmas for advocates, immigration advocates. They're trying to point out to U.S. officials that, look, you can call these people victims of poverty, but you also have to call them, to a certain extent, war refugees. Mm. Because the violence in places like El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras these days is just as horrific as it was during the civil wars of that generation
ago.
And
I want to ask you about that, the engagement on the part of the United States. I mean, so much of the State Department is focused on what's going on in Ukraine, clearly, maybe perhaps a little bit of it with what's going on in Venezuela, but there's been a long history of U.S. involvement in Central America, in these countries, in El Salvador, Nicaragua, especially going back to the Reagan years, if not before then. What is the engagement here if the U.S. military acknowledges this dangerous corner of the Western Hemisphere? What's the diplomatic engagement?
Well, the U.S. has poured in almost about $500 million into this region in the past few years, and for good reason. They don't want to see it become a sort of a domino that falls. Well, a generation ago, it was a domino that would have fallen to the communists.
Right.
Now they don't want these dominoes to fall to the cartels. And one of the reasons that you're seeing little tiny El Salvador become such a priority for the United States is that for all its problems, it's actually a place where democratic institutions are working, which is what, you know, this week's successful election results have shown us, and the fact that the military is not getting engaged. So the U.S. is looking at El Salvador and saying, you know, if we could just keep this place stable, that could do a lot to help the rest of that northern triangle of Central America bear this out.
Is the State Department of the United States accepting these this razor-thin election result in El Salvador?
I think they have to. I think they have to because independent international election observers are not seeing any evidence of the fraud that the right-wing party is claiming. They're not completely happy with accepting Sanchez because he is more of the left-wing ilk of the FMLN party, and they're worried that he will try to move El Salvador into the arms of Venezuela, for example. So there is some tension there.
And Tim Padgett covers Latin America for WLRN, and that the point that I think we want to get to here is the risk or the attention that the new El Salvador president has, or the affinity that he may have for the Venezuelan experience.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, he has called Venezuela, I think, a beacon of democracy. I think that's just sort of lefty rhetoric that's really not going to become borne out, because as one of our analysts this week told us, El Salvador is so dependent on the U.S. economy, yeah, that I think his exact words were, it would be almost suicidal for any Salvadoran government to get into the same kind of conflict with Washington that Venezuela has been in for the past decade.
Well, you can find more of Tim Padgett's analysis on our website, WLRN.org, and you can hear him on air every week. Coming up, setting your complaints to music. We check in with WLRN arts reporter Christine DiMattei on a special pledge drive edition of the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Sammy Mack.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
It's time to speak out. School shouldn't be as stressful and shouted. We will run out of resources.
Today, arts reporter for WLRN Miami Herald News. What is this song all about?
Oh, I just beat that up with a spoon.
Go ahead, Chris.
That is FIU's complaints choir. Isn't that lovely?
What is a complaints choir?
It is exactly what it sounds like. You just stand there with a group of people and you just sing your complaints. This is a litany of complaints, quite literally.
But it is a coordinated. Somebody's written this music, though. We've gathered together the complaints and put them in a musical form. You're able to take criticize and you harmonize.
That is correct.
How did this come together?
Well, this was born of a project that the Wolfsonian FIU Museum put together. They have an event called The Power of Design, and it's now in progress, by the way, if you want to go. And this year's theme examines the power of complaining, how griping about a bad situation. We all know this. Griping will lead to action. Action leads to change, and that's anything. That's architecture. That's government. Anything. So the FIU professors and the staff of the Wolfsonian were brainstorming about this year's event. One of them said, hey, have you heard about this crazy thing? Have you seen it on YouTube? Complaints choirs. Boom. They took it to the Honors College. The Honors College kids went on campus, compiled the complaints. They had a list of 500.
So what are some of these complaints that were compiled? What are some of your favorites?
My favorites. People need to stop twerking. Now I hate this one. When you take a friend bowling for the very first time in their lives and they get nothing but strikes all night.
Oh, no.
Happens to me all the time. When your cookie is too big to dunk into your cup. All right.
Now, that is a design problem.
But here's one that had me scratching my head. From an FIU student, not enough emphasis is put on the importance of paleontology.
Now, you know, everybody's got their thing, Chris.
I'll have this young person know that I always watch Walking with Dinosaurs, so I don't know what they're talking about.
What's marvelous about these are very highly specific complaints. They're not, I hate the traffic. I can't get through town fast enough. These are very targeted complaints. And when a complaint is targeted, then you can get a solution to it, or you can at least generate ideas in which to address the complaint.
Not always. I mean, if I'm being tailgated, by some monster on I-95. How do I translate that?
Yeah, but if your cookie's too big for your glass of milk, you either get a smaller cookie or a bigger glass of milk. That's easy.
This is
but
true.
But if you're complaining and singing about bad traffic or it's too hot outside, these are things that you may or may not have control over. And I guess the point is the art of complaining, right, Chris, has got to be something that can be addressed in a relatively short period of time, I suppose, or address the complaint to the right audience.
Absolutely true. And it's interesting to note that universally, the numero uno complaint, no matter where you are in the world, Helsinki, Great Britain, Tokyo, is about public transportation. This is the numero uno complaint. They all have, the buses don't run on time, the trains. So when I was researching this, I found this very, very interesting.
There's not enough trains, the trains are too crowded, the buses are too crowded, any of those.
Yep. Now, you are actually collecting your own singing complaints, right?
We are. WLRN wants its own sort of on-air complaints choir, and here's what we're doing. We are reaching out to our listeners. We want you to sing, people. We want you to sing. We want you to sing your grievances to the tune of The Rolling Stones, You Can't Always Get What You Want, and then send us your audio. We're going to string them all together in that tune. Voila. The result will air on these, on our station, okay? So, and getting your audio to us is very easy. You just call 305-330-9576, or you can go to WLRN.org. We've got a complaints choir link for you to click there. Mm-hmm. We need your audio. Come on. We know you've got gripes about anything and everything. Come on.
And WLRN is co-presenting this Power of Design Festival at the Wolfsonian, right?
Absolutely.
We are there. Absolutely. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN and let us know your complaints. Christine DiMatte covering arts. For Sammy Mack, I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup here on this Friday, March 21st, the first Friday of spring. Thanks, everybody, for listening. It is produced by Elaine Chin and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Executive producer Peter Mertz and our technical supervisor Michael Stock. South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell is next. The local folk music scene in the 1960s is what Ed will be talking about. We'll see you Monday morning at 9 for the Sunshine Economy. Have a great weekend.